From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. There will be no government shutdown tonight, and $600 checks will be going out soon directly to people in need. But President Trump's decision to delay signing that massive coronavirus relief deal until last night means that millions of unemployed Americans will go a week without benefits because they expire the night before, Saturday night. Also today, even though the president signed the bill with those $600 checks, the House is in session to try to force a vote on increasing direct checks to $2,000, as he had demanded. NPR White House correspondent Franco Ordonez joins us. Hi, Franco.
Hello.
So again, to review, President Trump balked on signing the bill last week because he wanted those $2,000 direct checks, among other things. What did he gain by delaying the signing?
Yeah, I mean, nothing really. I mean, he sought these higher checks and spending cuts, and, you know, he really gave only these vague assertions that Congress would take it up. But Democrats have made very clear that they won't agree to the cuts, and most Republicans are unlikely to approve the higher checks.
Yeah, well, what else does President Trump want Congress to do in exchange for his signature, and are they likely to do it?
What he wants, or what he says he wants, is for both chambers to increase those payments to $2,000. He also said he's sending back a, quote, redlined version of the bill to take out what he describes as wasteful spending. Now, the House, led by Democrats, they plan to vote this afternoon to increase the direct payments. But it's unclear whether the Republican-led Senate will take it up. Many leaders say it won't pass anyways. The reality is this, the direct payments and the spending cuts are more, you know, just suggestions. And it's really unclear how seriously Congress will take it up.
Okay, but to what people want to know, is the White House making it clear when checks will go out? When will people be able to get some of the other help that's also in the relief bill?
Yeah, that's also kind of a jump ball. I mean, before Trump turned on his own negotiators, Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin said last week that Americans could see the payments in a matter of days. But, you know, so much has changed, obviously. I mean, the best answer is probably hopefully soon.
Okay. Lawmakers are also counting votes this week on whether they can override President Trump's veto of the defense spending bill. It almost routinely passes in every year. Things like military raises are at stake there. So what's likely to happen?
Yeah, that's another really big question. Again, Trump contributed to the chaos here. The $740 billion package, you know, really strong, passed with strong majorities in both the House and the Senate. Now we'll see if those majorities hold as both chambers are expected to vote this week, you know, to override Trump's veto. If you remember, he, you know, raised some concerns about the, you know, bill to that had provisions to rename military bases honoring Confederate leaders, as well as some protections for internet companies.
Yeah, he wants those protections stripped away.
Right.
Well, we'll wait to see how that unfolds. But meanwhile, the normally pro-Trump New York Post, owned by Fox News owner Rupert Murdoch, has a cover and an editorial highly critical of Trump today. The headline is, "Stop the Insanity, You Lost the Election." It warns the president about becoming the King Lear of Mar-a-Lago, focusing so much on overturning the election on January 6th. That's the Georgia Senate runoffs. That's the electoral count, that he overlooks the Georgia Senate runoffs the day before. So what about Georgia? Trump says he'll hold a rally there.
Yeah, you know, this all this, you know, talk and the, you know, holdout of the relief bill really didn't make things easier for the Republican candidates. You know, both the Republican candidates, you know, the Republican senators who are, you know, in this runoff are running, are, you know, voted for the legislation and touted it as bringing relief to voters. The fact is, you know, Trump calling it a disgrace actually gave the Democratic challengers ammunition for political ads and messaging. And as you note, you know, Trump's going to campaign there right before the election. And, you know, he's just, you know, continuing to cast false doubt on the election systems there while also saying it's imperative for Georgians to vote for Perdue and Loeffler, the two senators. So it's a really difficult situation.
Well, and just briefly, we have about a minute. Where is President-elect Joe Biden in all this when it comes to Georgia? Yeah,
you know, Biden has also been very critical of President Trump about the relief packaging, you know, warning of devastating consequences if, you know, President Trump didn't sign. You know, we should see and hear from the president-elect today. He's planning to deliver remarks this afternoon after he meets with his national security and foreign policy review teams. You know, and his team is also making some news. In an interview with CNBC, one of Biden's advisors said he plans to actually invoke the Defense Production Act to boost production of COVID vaccines after he takes office, soon after.
Okay, we'll look for that today. NPR White House correspondent Franco Ordonez, thank you.
Thank you.
Here in Los Angeles, health officials have begun testing patients for a new, more contagious strain of the coronavirus, first discovered in Europe. They're trying to figure out why we're seeing a surge in cases here. One person dies from the virus every 10 minutes in LA County. And hospitals are rationing care, urging people to avoid going to the ER unless they absolutely have to. For the latest, we're joined by Dr. Anne Ramoyne, professor of epidemiology at UCLA. Welcome, doctor.
Hi. Nice to be here.
Yes. So LA County, as I mentioned, is testing whether the variant of the virus, like the one in London, South Africa, and Korea, could be spreading here. What do we know about these efforts and this new strain?
Well, this is very important. Los Angeles County, the laboratory is active, or laboratories are actively sequencing strains. And it's not only important to be looking for this UK strain and the South African strain or variant, should I say, but others as well. We're far behind here in the U.S. in sequencing efforts, and viral surveillance is a critical component of public health surveillance. And this is a very, very important moment to be doing it. We're seeing a huge spread here in Los Angeles. There are a variety of reasons that this could be happening, but it is critical to be doing this kind of viral surveillance.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the variety of reasons why this could be happening. If a new strain is spreading locally, how did it get here, and what additional action should be taken to limit the spread?
Well, if the strain is if these particular strains, the UK, the variants, the UK variant or the South African variant, are actually spreading here in Los Angeles, which would make good sense, then they probably were arrived through travel. Somebody either coming from Europe or somebody coming going and coming back from Europe. But the thing is, it isn't just about the UK. It's not just about South Africa. We are seeing many, many European countries outside the UK have recorded cases. Denmark, France, Germany, Italy, the Netherlands, Spain, Sweden. It's been detected even in Toronto in a couple with no history of travel exposure or high-risk contacts. So this particular UK variant is spreading. And because we here in the United States have been sequencing less than 1% of the cases that we have here, as opposed to 7% or more in the UK, 50% in New Zealand and Australia, you know, we're very, very far behind. So the bottom line is, it's very likely that either these particular variants or other variants that are similar are spreading in our community, and we just have not been looking for them.
And thank you for that distinction between strain and variant. We're talking about variants here.
Variants.
Yes. We understand things like holiday gatherings and possibly this new variant of the virus could be accelerating the spread. But what else could be the reason the surge seemed to happen so quickly here in Los Angeles?
Here in Los Angeles, we have the most populous county here in the U.S. And so you have a lot of opportunity for spread. We know that people are fatigued and that they have been getting together. A lot of people got together for Thanksgiving, and so we're seeing the effects of those Thanksgiving get-togethers now. And I think that here in L.A. County, we have a lot of multi-generational households as well, a lot of essential workers. So there's plenty of opportunity for spread. And once this virus gains momentum, it's like a snowball rolling downhill. It just gains momentum. It gets bigger and faster and harder to stop. So some of it is just the force of infection.
The force of infection. There's also this new data out in LA County that shows that some grocery stores are hotspots for the virus. And that's alarming, because going to the store is a trip that most people take because the risks seem low. What is your advice on how to stay safe in what is now some of the darkest days of this pandemic?
I think that the key here is everything that you're doing today here in Los Angeles is more dangerous than it was a month ago. Every type of activity. I've seen estimates of anywhere between 1 in 100 and 1 in 50 people in Los Angeles are infected. And so even if you're just going to the grocery store, for example, or going to the bank or doing anything where you're going to be in contact with people outside your household, there's a higher chance today than there was a few weeks ago that you'll be exposed to COVID-19. So I think the key here is, just because you can do something doesn't mean you should. There are a lot of things that are still permitted here, but they may not be the right thing to do because they will carry risks for you and the people around you. So my advice to people is, stay home if you can. If you must go out, make your plans ahead of time. Be very targeted. If you need to go to the grocery store, have a list and break it down by the sections of the grocery store if you know where you're going. Make it quick, in and out.
That's Dr. Anne Ramoyne, professor of epidemiology at UCLA. Thank you so much.
It's my pleasure.
The family of Andre Hill is speaking out. The unarmed black man was killed by police on December 22nd as he exited a friend's garage in Columbus, Ohio. City officials are holding a hearing today to decide whether to fire police officer Adam Coy, who didn't turn his body cam on early enough before shooting Hill and didn't render Hill aid, which is seen on what tape there is. Here's Hill's sister, Shauna Barnett, speaking on CNN Today.
I saw them take my brother's life, snatch his life away within a matter of seconds. No questions asked or anything.
Both Columbus Police Chief Tom Quinlan and Mayor Andrew Ginther are recommending that Officer Coy be removed from the force. Nick Evans is a reporter at member station WOSU in Columbus. And Nick, this hearing is about deciding whether to fire Coy for breaking those regulations. I understand he was not at the hearing this morning. So who was, and what do we know happened?
Right. Coy did not show up. Members of the Fraternal Order of Police, the local police union, were there on his behalf. Unfortunately, we don't know a ton of what happened. It happens behind closed doors. We heard in a statement from the public safety director, Ned Pettis, that he is now going to weigh the evidence and the recommendation from the chief of police, and he will render a decision. He said it will be prompt, but we don't really have details as to exactly when that will come down.
Yeah. And again, the hearing, the police chief and the mayor all are not considering Coy's, you know, the actual shooting. The chief and the mayor are saying they want Coy fired because he didn't turn his camera on. And also, what is the question regarding rendering aid?
Right. So the big point that the chief and the mayor have made throughout this is that we're going to set aside the question of what happened with the shooting. But the fact that this officer didn't have his body camera on when he showed up at the scene and turned it on after pulling the trigger. But then also, you know, Coy and other officers didn't immediately go over to, put pressure on wounds and the like, you know, while Hill was lying on the ground dying. They say those two things together are enough to prompt them to recommend removing him from the force.
Right. And Nick, it can get a little confusing. You and I spoke last week. The officer, Coy, didn't turn his camera on until after the shooting, but it has a look
right
back. And so the video,
exactly,
we can see some of the video, which is very disturbing. And here is some of Chief Quinlan's announcement last week.
I have filed two departmental charges alleging critical misconduct against Officer Coy. After an expedited investigation, I have sustained those charges. Based on these findings, I am recommending discipline of termination.
And how rare is it to see the police chief call for that first before even a hearing?
To be frank, in a word, it's stunning. You know, we have seen stories like this play out in cities around the country. And to have, you know, the local officials here in basically less than a week, you know, basically say, we're going to parse this incident. We're going to set aside the question of the shooting, but we have enough evidence based on the idea of not having the camera on and not rendering aid. We have enough to go on to say that we think that we should move forward and remove this guy from the force. I don't think I've ever seen anything quite like that.
Yeah, we should just say briefly that this is the second death of an unarmed black man in your city in a month. It's separately, a sheriff's deputy in Columbus who isn't yet required to wear a body cam shot and killed an unarmed black man named Casey Goodson Jr. There is an investigation into that. But just briefly, you say that this hearing today, we might hear from officials today. What's your sense of the feeling there in Columbus?
I mean, I would caution that I don't really expect for us to hear from the safety director today on this. My guess is that, you know, he'll probably at least sleep on it, and we'll have an update, you know, sometime soon. In terms of the Casey Goodson shooting, you know, we don't really have any new information on that. The Columbus police are handling that investigation, not the sheriff's office. And in both of these incidents, the local U.S. attorney is reviewing the cases for civil rights charges. In terms of, like, public activists, you know, we are hearing the things that we've been hearing since, you know, George Floyd, you know, no justice, no peace, that sort of thing.
And many people of color in Columbus saying they don't feel safe. Nick Evans of member station WOSU, thank you so much.
Anytime. Happy to do it.
Let's turn back to the pandemic. More than 18 million Americans have been infected by the coronavirus since the pandemic began. It's a shocking number, but as disturbing, a third will have serious symptoms months after they test negative, something the CDC announced back in July. And we've spoken since to several so-called long haulers here. Perhaps the most surprising aspect is the range of medical issues they're confronting: lung and heart damage, glaucoma, new onsets of diabetes and anti-immune disorders, hair loss, mental fog, dental issues. It's hard to believe this is all from a single disease. We want to check back with Diana Berendt, herself a long hauler and founder of the Survivor Corps Support and Research Group, Thousands Belong. Diana, welcome back.
Thank you so much for having me on, Robin.
Yeah. And when we spoke in September, you just received very surprising news to you that you developed glaucoma. You were also having stomach issues, crushing headaches, 6 months after you were told you no longer had COVID-19. So how are you doing now?
I'm doing a lot better, actually. It's been 9.5 months. And, you know, I liken it to what I experienced almost of had like a severe concussion with the headaches and earaches and other issues that I was experiencing. And I've sort of treated it and tried to treat it like that in terms of the recovery. And I have to say that I'm doing so much better. But the frightening part about this is that you don't know what sort of invisible damage has been done within your body. And so it's hard to say, you know, we've been using this one-third.
Oops, hopefully we're going to get her back because I want to ask her about her 12-year-old. Hi there. You know, we just lost you for a second. You were saying you used this one-third. That's okay. You use this one-third and then...
Yeah. And so with that, we are assuming that those are just the people who remain ill after the virus. But it's not counting the many people who have invisible damage in their body from mild cases of COVID that aren't coming to the surface for months later. My son is a perfect example. He had a mild case of COVID last winter. He was 11 years old. I never would have considered him a long hauler kid. He wasn't having any symptoms. And then about 6 weeks ago, he was sitting on the couch watching TV, as one does during a pandemic. And out of nowhere, one of his front adult teeth came out spontaneously with no blood loss. I rushed him to the oral surgeon's office and they said, well, you know, they'd never seen anything like it. They said that it should have looked like a murder scene, but there was zero blood and there had evidently been vascular damage. And we're still trying to figure out whether it was damage to the tooth, to the jaw, to the gum. And I immediately posted on Survivor Corps and said, you know, has anyone else experienced this? And the numbers started pouring forward. And it was shocking to see the number of people who were having dental issues, extreme dental issues. And so, you know, I think that it makes us revisit that one-third number.
Doctors are looking at the tooth loss. You know, people are looking into that. But you also told us the frustration of doctors not believing patients. Where are we on that?
You know, I think that we are making improvements, unfortunately, just due to the sheer numbers. So we are at over 19 million documented infections. Who knows how many actual infections? And so the sheer numbers of people reporting these things are starting to increase to the point where they really can't be ignored. The problem is that each individual doctor is only seeing a subset. They might see one cracked tooth or one lost tooth, but one of our goals at Survivor Corps is to create a repository of all of this data. And we have the largest data set on non-hospitalized COVID patients in the world. And so we're able to use our membership and constantly do polls. And so we went ahead and did a dental poll to see if people were by and large having dental issues or if this was just a one-off, crazy thing that, happened to just a couple of people. And we found that 27.5% of the 850 people we asked did report dental problems. And of those, half of them had had cracked teeth. That requires serious dental coverage. And most people don't have dental insurance.
I'm going to jump in, Diana, to say, obviously your work has been extraordinary. You've gone from being a patient to also being a researcher. We're going to link people up at herenow.org. We'll check in with you again. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me on.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. A lawyer turned citizen journalist was sentenced to 4 years in prison today in China. Zhang Zhang was charged with what authorities called picking fights and provoking trouble when she documented the early stages of the pandemic in Wuhan back in February. The BBC's Stephen McDonald joins us from Beijing. And Stephen, we know we're talking about China, but these charges, picking fights and provoking trouble?
This is a crime that dissidents are often silenced with in China. So you'll often hear someone being accused of picking quarrels and provoking trouble. It is as vague as it sounds, and this helps the authorities to, frankly, lock up troublemakers.
Well, we know the Communist Party in China cracked down on doctors in Wuhan who were trying to get the word out early on about the coronavirus, accusing them of rumor mongering. I do remember seeing this woman or hearing of her early on, just specifically some of the things she was trying to say.
For example, what she would do was kind of go live on Weibo, which is one of the platforms here, or on WeChat even. And these are platforms normally very heavily censored. And she would be sort of walking through a crowded hospital and interviewing people or talking to those trying to receive treatment or even asking people what they thought of the messages coming from the government, just sort of normal vox pops in the street. Now, in other countries, that might not sound so remarkable, but in China, it is something that's quite unusual. And she started to get a bit of a following as a result of this. Now, she wasn't the only one. There were been about six people at least who have been picked up for doing just this sort of thing. And because what it flies in the face of is the government's message that the coronavirus has been handled so well here. I mean, the Chinese government does have a good story to tell about that, but it doesn't mean that it's been without problems in terms of its own responses, especially in the beginning. There are accusations of cover-ups, of, misleading the public. And so perhaps because of this, they've just decided to come down very hard on Zhang Zhan, to silence her and also to let this very severe sentence be a lesson to everyone.
Well, Zhang Zhan was arrested in May, and we know she's been on a hunger strike. So was she in court today at the sentencing? And do people know how she looks or how she is?
So according to her lawyers, she was looking not very healthy today, which is what you would expect from someone who's been on a hunger strike. They say the authorities in the detention center have been force-feeding her. It sounds like she was in a pretty bad state. I say it sounds like. Reporters weren't allowed into the courtroom, neither were her friends, just a few family members. I think it doesn't sound good for her in terms of her health into the future, that's for sure.
Well, does Zhang Zhan have any chance to appeal this? Is this a done deal?
Yeah, I mean, in theory, you can appeal it. But the trouble is with Chinese courts, they're completely rigged. They do what the Communist Party wants them to do. There is no independent judiciary in China. And so given that this is a highly political case, it's a case involving someone who's been threatening the government. And also, unfortunately for her, this isn't her first run-in with the authorities. This is partly why she's been given such a harsh sentence.
That's the BBC's Stephen McDonnell in Beijing. Stephen, thank you so much. We'll follow this story.
Good to talk to you.
Wonder Woman 1984 made nearly $17 million this Christmas weekend. That's the highest grossing debut for any film since the pandemic began. We wanted to revisit the origins of the women who inspired comic book writer William Moulton Marston's creation of the Wonder Woman character, warriors known to the Greeks as the Amazons. For centuries, scholars assumed these Amazon women were just the stuff of legend. But last year, a discovery at a Russian gravesite added evidence to claims that the Amazons were very much real. Here's my conversation about this with Adrienne Mayer, a historian at Stanford University who studied these women warriors.
So let's talk first about what these archaeologists found in Russia recently, north of the Black Sea. What did they find inside of these graves?
They have been working in that area for almost the past 10 years, maybe longer. They have found previous burials of female warriors buried with their weapons and horses. But this is the first time that they have found four warrior women buried together with their weapons. And their age range is quite significant, ranging from the age of 45 to 50 down to about 12 or 13. These four women were companions in warfare, probably died in a skirmish, and were buried together.
Fascinating. These women are thought to have actually been Scythian nomads who lived some 2,500 years ago. What else can you tell us about their culture?
They belong to tribes of nomads of the steppes. They roamed the vast territory of the region known in antiquity as Scythia. That was a land stretching from the Black Sea all the way east to Mongolia. The Chinese built the Great Wall of China to keep them out. So these were fierce, warlike tribes. They were the first people to domesticate and then ride horses, and they perfected the invention of the recurve bow. So their lives centered on horses and archery. And they taught boys and girls how to ride and shoot from childhood so that everyone in the tribe could hunt and defend the tribe.
Let's talk a little bit more about that. The first reference to the Amazons come from Homer, the legendary author of the Iliad and the Odyssey. But tell us more about how the Greeks wrote and thought about them.
Well, Homer did first describe them in his epic poem about the Trojan War, the Iliad, as you said. That was written in about 750 to 650 B.C., and Homer called the Amazons the equals of men. One ancient historian from Greece said that these tribes in Scythia were so savage that even the women went to war. So there were several ancient historians such as Herodotus in the 5th century B.C. and then later Strabo and Plato in the 4th century. They never doubted that Amazons really existed, and they related them to the real women of the nomadic tribes. But the myths, we don't know the origin of the myths. They were first written down by Homer. They were the mythic arch enemies of the Greeks, the greatest heroes of myth. Heracles or Hercules, Theseus, Achilles, they all had to prove their battle, valor, and skills in duels with Amazon queens. And remember, you can only win honor if you fight and defeat a really powerful and strong adversary. So Amazons fit that role. Theseus of Athens, he captured the Amazon Antiope, brought her back to Greece to be his bride. And then according to myth, a huge Amazon army vowed revenge and they invaded Athens to rescue her. That monumental battle against the Amazons was Athens' proudest victory. They portrayed images of that hard-won victory everywhere in their city, in the Acropolis and on the shield of Athena. Amazons played a role in the legendary Trojan War. As we know, Penthesilea was the queen of the Amazons. She brought a band of female warriors to fight on the side of the Trojans, and she dueled with the Greek champion Achilles. He won, but in the myth, he regretted killing such a brave and beautiful enemy, and there are vase paintings from the 5th century BC that show him killing her and then making eye contact and supposedly falling in love with the dying Amazon.
You know, Adrian, as you speak and you relay all of this, I'm like going off into another world just imagining all of this. I mean, it's so descriptive, and it's why I guess this whole idea has become such a part of our culture. But I want to ask you, if Homer wrote about these women, Plato wrote about these women, so many others, why did it take modern scholars so long to believe the Amazons had actually been living, breathing women?
Well, I think that modern historians and scholars tended to assume that Amazons were just a purely Greek invention. They like to credit the Greek imagination, the storytelling imagination. They thought of them as symbols of sort of monstrous women because their lifestyle was the opposite of proper Greek female roles. Some historians thought that Amazons were sort of, especially in art, stand-ins for the Persians, real enemies of the Greeks who also lived in far eastern lands and used archery and dressed much like Scythians. One ancient historian, one classicist, claimed Amazons were invented just to be killed by Greek male warriors. So the only good Amazon was a dead one. Other historians claimed that Amazons served as a kind of propaganda to oppress Greek women, to show Greek women and girls how uppity females would be doomed to die.
Wow.
So I think all those are sort of questionable now. Of course, we have compelling evidence that real women living the lifestyle of Amazons in myth really existed.
You know, you talked about some of those other myths. There's also this one myth that keeps coming up over and over, that the Amazons were so dedicated to their warcraft that they would cut off one of their breasts to shoot their bows better. Is this true?
That is a libel. It's a fake fact that has stuck like super glue for more than 2,500 years. If people think they know anything about Amazons, it's that supposed fact. That story first surfaced in about 490 BC. A patriotic Greek historian attempted to force a Greek meaning on the word Amazon. Amazon is not a Greek word originally, and it was borrowed from some other ancient culture. We don't know which. But because it sounded a little bit like the word for breast, mazon, and if you put an A in front of it, it means without, so they thought he suggested it meant without breast, and that demanded a story. So people said, well, maybe they cut off one breast so they could draw a bow, shoot arrows, and that's a physiologically silly idea. And in fact, it was rejected by other Greek writers in antiquity, and even more significantly, not one ancient artist ever bought that idea. All Amazons in Greek and Roman art are double-breasted. And anyone who practices archery knows that breasts are not a hindrance.
Exactly. Well, there really is no doubt that the Amazon women have had a hold on our psyches. I was a huge Wonder Woman fan as a little girl. I actually remember that being one of the first ventures into imaginary play. Why do you think we continue to be so fascinated by this idea, which is a reality?
Well, the ancient Greeks, they were fascinated because it was so different from their own mothers and wives and daughters. And the idea that women could be equals of men was sort of disturbing to them, but also attractive. They had very ambivalent feelings about it. I think many people do today still have ambivalent, mixed feelings about that. I kind of think for the ancient Greeks, the stories of those audacious Amazons that fought their biggest heroes, that sort of gave them a kind of safe place, an exciting way to imagine equality between the sexes in a sort of myth. And I think today, well, the struggles to find balance and harmony between men and women, that's just universal. You can see it in Greece and Persia and Egypt and China and India in their stories of warrior women. And now, the fact that we can read the myths and now know the realities about an egalitarian culture, that not only gives us a sort of romantic, thrilling stories, about men and women who could be equals, but now we know that there was a kernel of truth underlying those stories. I think there's sort of always been Amazons in myth. Sometimes they're hidden, sometimes they're out in the full view, but now the historical reality is coming to light, and it's thanks to archaeological discoveries like the one reported this month.
That was Adrian Mayer, a historian of ancient science at Stanford University, speaking with us earlier this year about the real women warriors the ancient Greeks called the Amazons, who inspired comic book writer William Moulton Marston to create the Wonder Woman character. This is Here and Now.
Around the world, sea turtles have had a tough time. Climate change is heating up the beaches where they nest and the waters where they live. Plastic is strangling them. Straw is impaling them out in the ocean. But there's potentially good news about sea turtles in South Florida near Biscayne Bay, which has had some major pollution. Jenny Stiletovich from member station WLRN recently spotted dozens of turtles in the bay and met a fisherman who says he's seen even more.
On a flat, calm day this summer, Dirk Jacobs was piloting his 22-foot fishing boat south near Miami, just outside Biscayne Bay. Jacobs has been fishing around South Florida and in Biscayne Bay since 1967.
I've seen the ups and downs. I've seen the reefs look horrible, and I've seen them look good.
That day, he says he saw something few people have ever seen, hundreds of sea turtles, like a herd of buffalo, thundering along the outer reef.
And I looked down because it was crystal clear. And there was just turtle after turtle after turtle after turtle. And it went on for however far it is from Sands Cut down to about Pacific Light. You were looking down on the water and it was one turtle after another.
If he truly saw hundreds of turtles, that would be something spectacular.
Chris Sasso is a fisheries biologist with the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. Seeing hundreds of turtles would be spectacular because marine biologists know hardly anything about what turtles do at sea. Scientists think Jacobs probably saw green sea turtles, along with loggerheads and other turtles that live around South Florida. They nest on beaches. But once they hatch, they're out of here. Females come back to beaches where they were born to lay eggs, but males never return. That means almost everything we know about turtles and how we can protect them is based on this very brief time they spend on beaches. Once they head out to sea, it's a mystery.
It's a bit like bobbing for apples, blindfolded in a way, because you may not know exactly where to look.
Kate Mansfield is director of the University of Central Florida's Marine Turtle Research Group. The marine biologist says it's her mission to uncover this time at sea, what scientists call the turtle lost years.
It takes about 25 to 35 years for a sea turtle to reach maturity. So they have to survive those 2 to 3 decades out in the open ocean.
Researchers used to think after hatching, the baby turtles floated aimlessly out at sea in mats of seaweed called sargassum. The sargassum is loaded with crabs and other kinds of turtle food.
There's this big circular series of currents in the Atlantic called the North Atlantic Subtropical Gyre and the Gulf Stream. So everyone just assumed that they would just ride this current around from the Gulf Stream to the North Atlantic Current, which would take them over to the Azores.
But now researchers have these tiny satellite trackers they can attach to the backs of baby turtles. And those trackers are telling a different story. Many of the baby turtles are actually swimming against currents and heading into the Sargasso Sea. That's the area at the center of all these Atlantic currents, filled with all that turtle food.
So what's really cool is that the Sargasso Sea is emerging as a very important nursery habitat for a lot of sea turtles that emerge off of our beaches up and down the Florida coast.
So why does all this matter to the turtles that the fishermen saw in July near Biscayne Bay?
I literally just got back from the Tortugas. Like, I'm still putting, like, sun stuff, you know, cream on my face.
Kristen Hart is really good at tracking animals. She's a population ecologist with the U.S. Geological Survey.
Some go really far and come back, but some actually don't. Biscayne is uniquely situated along the migratory corridor for a lot of animals. So that's one of my questions generally. Like, am I going to have a lot of resident animals, or are they just going to be cooking through?
Hart thinks waters around Biscayne Bay may be home to more turtles than scientists have thought. And watching them could provide really important clues about those lost years and how turtles mate.
What we thought we knew, because a lot of the tagging has been on nesting females, you track them back to where they go, and then you're like, okay, it lives there. But if you're a male, or if you're becoming a mature individual, when are you making your, what I call, risky movements? Or where are you going to mate?
And if turtles are staying near Biscayne Bay, bustling with boat traffic and, in normal times, cruise ships and freighters, what threats do they face? That's where Sasso, the NOAA marine biologist, comes in. He's studying how ocean traffic affects turtles. It may be that turtles, like manatees, need special low-speed zones where they hang out.
One of the larger concerns for sea turtles, much like manatees, are boat strikes, because they do spend time, you know, loafing at the surface, and sometimes they're kind of...
We already know how to protect turtles when they nest on beaches. Their nests get marked so they don't get trampled. Also, streetlights and floodlights from nearby buildings have been changed so turtles don't get confused trying to make it out to sea. And nesting numbers, especially for green sea turtles, are way up. What fisherman Dirk Jacobs saw on his boat that day?
Just turtle after turtle after turtle after turtle.
Could be a sign that they're doing better at sea, too.
God, if 2020 could be good for something, it'd be nice if it were good for turtles.
For Here and Now, I'm Jenny Stiletovich.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm rooting for the turtles. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now.